Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Well, Kellen, the topic of today's episode is not one that should come as any surprise to, you know, why it's related to collapse. This is something that global warming, we know, is happening. We've discussed at length the effects that it will have and is having on the world. And today's topic is something that's going to make global warming worse, and it's El Niño. It's especially relevant right now because every day that goes by, there's a higher and higher likelihood that we're heading back into an El Niño year. Obviously, we don't yet know the strength of it. That will come with time. But we thought it would be a good opportunity to discuss what is El Niño, why is it important, and what effect is it going to have on the world as climate change continues on.
Yeah, in fact, before we dive in too deep, let me put this in context for us. Here's a sentence from an article about El Niño. It says, back in 1997/98, a massive El Niño in the Pacific Ocean pushed global temperatures to new highs and triggered a spate of extreme weather around the world, ultimately causing some $35 billion in damage and 23,000 deaths. Now, to be fair, that was the largest El Niño on record. But with, like you said, climate change taking place, temperatures are rising more and more, the severity of these El Niños is likely to get much worse.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop for sure. And I also expect, and we'll talk again about consequences from El Niño later on in the episode, but that those consequences will magnify in an exponential way as climate change continues.
Awesome. So let's talk about what El Niño is.
I believe it's Spanish for the Niño. Is that right?
The Niño. Yeah, Corey, you and I have both learned Spanish from having lived in foreign countries. And to me, it seems like such a funny name because El Niño is the boy or the child. So first of all, as we dive in here, you might think, why is it called El Niño? And it's because there were some South American fishermen in the 1800s. They noticed that every few years, the temperature of the water was warmer. And this coincided with major decreases in their ability to catch fish. And we'll talk about why that's the case, that when it's an El Niño year in South America, it's a bad fishing year. But because this usually happened around December, they started calling it El Niño de Navidad, which Navidad, you probably are aware, is Christmas. Or another way to translate that, El Niño de Navidad is the Christ child. So later, it became known as simply El Niño. And you might sometimes hear ENSO or ENSO, which is El Niño / Southern Oscillation. And it's something that's cyclical, kind of the opposite of it when temperatures get colder in those parts of the world. They call it La Niña.
Which is the female Christ child.
Yeah, they never went as far as to say La Niña de Navidad.
Okay.
In fact, for a while, actually, one of the terms, instead, they were saying El Niño was when the water was warmer. And the cyclical times where the water would get colder, they called it El Viejo, or like the old person. Anyways, but because it's kind of the opposite, they started going back and forth between El Niño and La Niña.
Sure.
So scientists, the parameters that they've put around this to declare an official El Niño is when sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean rise 0.5 degrees Celsius above their historical average for 3 months in a row. And then typically atmospheric conditions and rainfall patterns shift accordingly. So now that we know in general what it is, let's dive into why it actually happens. So I have read several articles on this. And in reading these articles, the one thing I'll say is that it is complex.
Yeah.
So doing the research, it's like I'd read about it and I would find these terms and I would have to go look up what those terms mean. And while learning about those terms, there would be other terms I'd have to go look up what they mean.
Kellen, I think I need to make a confession, and it's that we split up the episode, right? And we like each kind of took a part of it. And I suggested the parts for this episode this time. And that was primarily because I had started to research how El Nino works and why. And I was like, no, this is, I can't do this. This is over my head. I'm going to make Kellen do this. And you gracefully accepted the challenge. So thank you.
Well, I nerd out on it. Like I enjoy that part of our episodes when we've talked about like nuclear fission or whatever, being able to figure out how it works is fascinating to me. So I'll do my best. I've tried to simplify it as much as possible. Essentially, the sun hits the equator more strongly. And so at the equator, where there's more warmth, air rises from the surface upwards. And cooler air rushes in to replace that warm air, which creates what we would call wind. Because of the rotation of the planet and what's called the Coriolis effect, the air moving around turns one direction in the northern hemisphere and another direction in the southern hemisphere. The movement of the air, or in other words, the wind, it creates this kind of chicken and egg situation. And I want to read just a couple of sentences from an article where somebody was describing this. The author said, "So if you ask me, why are there trade winds? I will say that's simple. There are trade winds because the water is cold in the east and warm in the west. But if you ask me, why is the water cold in the east and warm in the west? I'll say, that's simple too. It's because there are trade winds. The ocean and the atmosphere are inextricably coupled together." So again, saying one causes the other, like it's a feedback loop. So when what you get is these trade winds that are driving warm water westward from like South America across the Pacific to Asia. And that warm water kind of piles up against the land, which makes it so that sea levels are about half a meter higher in Indonesia than they are in South America. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
It also means that sea surface temperatures near Indonesia are about 8 degrees Celsius warmer than they are near Peru. So if you can kind of envision in your mind, this water is all moving westward across the Pacific and it's kind of piling up this warm water. That warm water, because of the warmth, it pushes heat and moisture up into the atmosphere. All of that heat and moisture rising up into the atmosphere becomes one of the driving forces behind the world's climate. It kind of sets a path for the jet streams. So it's been compared to the way that like a rock in a stream determines the water flow, right? The water has to flow around it. When you've got all this warm air rising up from that part of the world, the jet stream has to kind of dodge around it. So at the same time, when that warm water is being pushed west away from South America, cold ocean water that is really nutrient heavy rises to the surface to take its place. So everything that I've described is what is happening during a neutral or a normal year. Any questions so far?
Nope. We're there. We're good.
Okay. So then during El Nino, what happens is those trade winds slow down. So the warm water isn't being pushed west quite so much. And in fact, it kind of starts to slosh back. So the warm water is now closer to the western coast of the U.S. and to South America. And again, where that warm water is, warm air and moisture rises into the air. So that causes the jet stream to get out of whack. I'll quote again from an article here. The warmer waters cause the Pacific jet stream to move south of its neutral position. With this shift, areas in the northern U.S. and Canada are drier and warmer than usual, but in the U.S. Gulf Coast and Southeast, these periods are wetter than usual and have increased flooding. And to me, it's just amazing how complex and intertwined the whole system is. Right? You get these winds that slow down, and suddenly that throws off the whole climate for the planet. One thing that's worth noting, one of the questions I had going into this is like, why does it happen? Why do the winds slow down? And the funny part about that is we don't know. There are some leading theories out there. There's one about how it's initiated by the reflection from what's called the oceanic Rossby wave. That is a type of low frequency planetary wave that moves only west. And that one I haven't dived into enough to be able to explain in detail. The other is that the trigger is basically random. And that it's caused when you get these like tropical storms that develop in the Indian Ocean. And since storms are geostrophic, again, meaning that they like rotate clockwise in the southern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the north, those storm winds at the equator always blow towards the east. And if the storm is strong enough and it lasts long enough, then maybe that's what causes the winds to kind of change direction a little bit or slow down. And that's where you get the ocean sloshing and everything starts to feed off of each other. So nobody knows exactly why it happens, but when it does happen, and by the way, whether it is El Nino or La Nina, it typically lasts between 9 and 12 months. Sometimes it can last for years, though, and there's not really a good way to predict that. How frequently does it take place? Apparently, it occurs every 2 to 7 years on average. Other sources said that it occurs every 3 years on average. But that strong El Nino events typically occur every 6 to 10 years. So I mentioned that in a normal year around South America, as you're getting all that warm water pushed west, the cold nutrient-rich water is rising up to the surface. And so this has a very dramatic effect on the amount of phytoplankton that there is, and that affects the amount of fish. So it has a big impact on marine life. There's indirect impacts on, you know, food supplies and prices, forest fires, the economy, you know, political implications. There's so many things. I know you're going to dive into that, Corey.
I don't need to now. You just spilled all the beans.
Stole your thunder. Anyways, I'm fascinated by the way this all works and the fact that it happens. But it is scary to me that in all of this, as much as we know about it and how it works, we can't really predict it. It can just spring upon us at any time, and it can have devastating impacts.
Yeah, the unpredictability of it definitely adds an interesting element to trying to understand it, to be prepared for it. And the cyclical nature of it also presents some challenges that we'll get into here in a moment. While they can't necessarily predict when they'll happen or how severe each one will be, they are starting to come out with studies saying that they do predict they're going to continue to get worse with climate change, that the more heat that is in the system, in the atmosphere, the stronger they're going to become. And actually, just recently, in the last 6 months or so, they've come out with some studies talking about how the Arctic melting, as we get more closer to a BOE, to blue ocean event and an ice-free summer, that is supposed to dramatically increase, potentially, the strength of El Niños in the future. So there you have a little bit of a feedback loop, because obviously stronger El Niño events create warmer atmospheres, which intensifies Arctic melting, which in turn makes El Niños stronger in the future. So I'm going to go through and just talk about some of the consequences here of El Niño in different parts of the world, and how those are kind of projected to change over time. So we just mentioned Arctic ice. Let's talk about Antarctic ice. So there's basically, again, new studies coming up out about this. I think a lot of research about El Niño is actually relatively new. But this new area of study, there's a report coming out saying that it's projected that stronger El Niños will mean deeper waters around Antarctic ice, which is going to accelerate the melting of ice shelves and grounding lines from underneath. So we've also seen other reports recently about how, like, Thwaites Glacier is melting more rapidly than had been previously expected. They're getting cameras in different places and finding that the grounding lines are retreating faster than they thought. And now they're saying that El Niño makes that much worse. What's interesting is they also said that surface temperatures may decrease a little bit, meaning that sea ice may melt more slowly, but overall the net impact is positive on melt. And that's interesting because Antarctica holds like 70 meters worth of sea level potential, right, in the ice. And obviously we're not expecting all of that to melt. But the faster that it happens, as the rate increases, the more impact we're going to see on sea level rise and on coastal areas. You mentioned that there is an increase in precipitation in the western areas of North and South America. So California, Peru, and Ecuador especially see an increase in rain during El Niño events. This can cause an increase in flooding. We just saw a pretty wild winter in California with the precipitation that went for like 20 days straight almost, with all these atmospheric rivers coming in. So atmospheric rivers are expected to intensify during El Niños just because there is that much more moisture in the atmosphere. Jumping across the other side of the world, Australia will see an increase in fires and droughts. You know, it's interesting to think about this. I had mentioned that the cyclical nature of El Niño, neutral years, and La Niña is actually a little bit concerning, because Australia has now had 3 years of above average rainfall. If you remember in 2020, end of 2019, there were those really intense bushfires there right before COVID hit. And the reason the cycle is scary is because you'll have a few years of intense rain, which increases vegetation, right? And then when the El Niño comes back and all that vegetation dies, it's just fresh kindling to start new fires again. So it is expected that in the year 2023-2024, as we potentially go into a new El Niño, depending on its strength, we'll likely see pretty intense fires again in Australia.
And it makes me think of other aspects of kind of that weather whiplash that we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you get these years where there's all these fires, and that's destroying the vegetation. And then you get heavy rains, and that just wipes everything away. Right? Because there's not the roots to be able to hold things together. You get big mudslides, stuff like that.
Correct. Yep, exactly. And increased flooding because the water isn't being soaked up by the vegetation. Okay, so going to Peru and Ecuador, you mentioned the decrease in fishing. So that used to be like the major impact of El Niño, right? It was sort of what started the whole noticing of it. So that lack of upwelling that you talked about means that essential nutrients for fish become scarce. The phytoplankton isn't as present. The fish either die or they have to migrate. And that does lead to serious economic issues for everyone whose livelihood is in fishing, right? And not just livelihood, but the food source for people that require it. So then, speaking about food source, this can cause drought and crop failures in eastern South America. So the Amazon, Brazil, Venezuela, other countries in the northeastern side as well, they start to expect less rainfall, which can cause crop failure and famine. In the past, it has had serious effects on crops in Brazil, like maize and things like that. And this isn't just in those parts of South America. The same thing also happens in the southern parts of Africa. Meanwhile, the eastern part of Africa is receiving more rain. So you're getting just this interesting dynamic where parts that usually aren't receiving rain are now getting a lot. Parts that are more used to it are now getting hardly any. And it's incredibly disruptive to the normal crop cycles. And especially for countries who are reliant on local crops, when that disappears and they're not able to import crops from other places, if they're net exporters, it can cause serious issues and famines for those local regions.
And obviously this isn't anything new, right? El Niño years have taken place in the past. La Niña years have taken place. We've talked about how this is cyclical. And it's been disruptive in the past, but what's especially scary to me is what we've mentioned here, how the likelihood of those intensifying as we go forward continues to increase as the planet heats up.
Yeah, and it's not just that they're intensifying, which is a big deal, but they're also being combined with all the other global issues that are occurring, right? We're already experiencing issues with famine. We're already experiencing issues with drought, with floods, the war in Ukraine and all the problems it's causing, supply chain issues because of COVID-19. Like, there are so many factors at play that the more and more complex it gets, you throw in things like El Niños, even if it's just the same strength as they usually are, and it can be the nail in the coffin that kind of disrupts things to a point that causes serious issues. Okay, so a couple other items here. It increases infectious diseases. So as temperatures rise, it actually creates a more fertile breeding ground for mosquitoes. And there's been a documented increase during El Niño years of dengue and malaria. There's also an increase in cholera around that time. The next one, which I thought was interesting, is that slowing growth of forest in different areas, so less vegetation in certain parts where there's drought, like the Amazon and Africa, India, and Australia, means that less CO2 is being absorbed, which can cause an intensified feedback loop of warming. You know, you look at charts of CO2 in the atmosphere or of global temperature, and it's always increasing, right, with global warming, but there's always these little bumps in it caused by El Niño events, and usually those bumps seem to accelerate things just a little bit. It doesn't come back down to where it was before. It always remains a little bit higher because there's this bit of a feedback loop that El Niños cause. So with each El Niño we get, we're getting an intensified warming of the planet. On that note, there's a likelihood of exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming years due to El Niño. And there's even the potential that we increase 1.5 degrees Celsius in 2023-2024, depending on how strong the El Niño is. It's said that El Niños can increase global temperature by as much as 0.2 degrees Celsius. At least that's for previous El Niños. And where we're now at 1.2 plus degrees above the baseline, there's potential that we hit 1.5. Now, when they measure 1.5, it's usually the average sustained over a few years' time. So hitting it in 1 year during an El Niño doesn't necessarily mean that we've surpassed 1.5. But those warming effects that come with 1.5, right, hitting that even for just 1 year makes it more likely that we'll continue to hit it thereafter.
Yeah, like you said, it triggers all those feedback loops, the blue ocean events, things like that.
Yeah, that's just it. It's such a complex science to it, right, that you or I don't understand. And frankly, the experts in it, in the field, don't completely understand. They can use models. They can try and understand it the best that they can, but there's still so much that's unknown about what stronger El Niños will do and how fast it'll do it. So one other effect here that I'll mention is in Europe. Southern Europe is expected to get wetter. They'll have more rain, while Northern Europe will be drier and colder. Europe was lucky this last winter in regards to, with everything going on in Ukraine and Russia, the decrease in availability of gas and other energy sources, people were really worried that prices were going to they did skyrocket, but there was less of a need because it's been warmer this year. If it had not been as warm as it was, a lot of people would have really struggled and suffered, or I should say a lot more people would have struggled and suffered under the pressure of those heavy prices and low supply. In an El Niño year, though, going into 2023-2024, if an El Niño does appear, it's going to be very cold in Northern Europe, and that's going to cause a lot of issues with regards to demand for energy. So that's a huge economic problem. It's a huge humanitarian crisis, and hopefully something will resolve with the war and the supply of gas before that happens.
Yeah, this is very worrisome to me because my understanding is from 2015 to 2022, those are the 8 warmest years on record, and yet we've had, like, what, 3 years in a row of a La Nina event. So if we've been in a La Nina cycle, and that's keeping the planet cooler than kind of what it should be, And yet it's been, you know, the warmest years on record. We flip and we're suddenly in an El Nino year. Like there's not any doubt in my mind that it's going to be record-breaking temperatures. And all of those impacts that you described have an immediate effect. But then, like we said, all the feedback loops that are triggered, all the ways in which that just accelerates global warming, on top of, like you said, all of the other issues that we're facing and that we're trying to battle, it feels like a major catalyst for, you know, increasing or accelerating collapse.
Yeah, I think we're in for a wild ride. And we'll kind of, probably in our bonus episodes, keep updating on El Nino, the strength that it's supposed to have as they come in with more numbers. Right now, I think it's like a 50% chance of an El Nino starting this fall. And I should say this fall in the Northern Hemisphere. But it's every month that goes by, that chance just keeps increasing.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.